This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is DJ Hybridist, otherwise known as Sandra Cross. Good afternoon, Sandra.
Hello, William.
Thank you for coming in again. You've been in several times. I think the last time was with your film Limbo.
That's right. Yes, we talked about the sound part of the film, yeah.
Right. But today, one day after International Women's Day and 90 years after all women over the age of 21 were allowed to vote, DJ Hybridist is here to share her selection of the strength of the female voice with Wavelength listeners. And from your own, what should we call it, press release, we have a list of funny women, sensual women, suicidal women, joyful women, sassy screwball women, protesting, politically engaged and annoyed women, musical women, modernist and modernising women, originators and original women. Which category might you fall into?
Well, I think probably we as women, I hope that we can embody elements of all of those things.
Okay.
So that's the goal.
Well, let's hope
And certainly Yoko Ono, I think, is...
Who we started with.
Yeah, who we started with. Obviously, it was called Woman Power because she never stopped saying it.
Right.
But I think it's pretty good.
Yeah.
That came from 1974, thereabouts. And
okay.
Yoko is a true original, a survivor in every conceivable way. And yes.
We saw her twice, in fact, didn't we, in London not so long ago?
Yes, that's right. And each time she was never less than staggering, really.
Yeah.
Once was at
Café Otto.
Yes, she was really utterly mesmerising, and just she had quite a visceral effect on me. Just her energy, her whole being, her whole way of being is tremendously powerful.
Yeah,
magnetic.
It was quite a short set, I seem to remember. It was only about an hour, but then she was sort of whisked away in a black limousine afterwards.
Yes, well, in that hour, it was concentrated energy, finely tuned energy. Her whole body just, taken with the sound.
Right.
The sounds that she was making.
And then I think we saw her briefly at the Festival Hall, wasn't she?
She did what people do during the summer. I've forgotten what it's called. Meltdown,
I think
it's called.
Right.
And she, I'm not sure if she was the overall director, but certainly she directed a part of it, and then she made her musical choices within that.
Yeah.
It's like a little chapter you get, isn't it? And she was the best part of that chapter.
Right, right.
Although, I must say, Boy George was in that section. He was very good too. But we're back to women, eh?
Yeah. So anyway, you've compiled a list of all these women's voices, which we're going to try and get through.
Yes.
I suppose we should press on because
we should go straight
you've got
into
quite a lot of tracks left to play here.
Mm.
Do you want to introduce them, or do you just want to kind of let them run and
I could introduce this one, which is a reading of A Vindication of the Rights of Women by Mary Wollstonecraft, which was written in 1792.
Right.
In which she argues that women are not naturally inferior to men, but appear to be only that way because they lack education.
Okay.
Mary Wollstonecraft, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, London, 1792. From the tyranny of man, I firmly believe, the greater number of female follies proceed, and the cunning, which I allow makes at present a part of their character, I likewise have repeatedly endeavoured to prove is produced by oppression. Were not dissenters, for instance, a class of people with strict truth characterised as cunning? And may not I lay some stress on this fact to prove that when any power but reason curbs the free spirit of man, dissimulation is practised, and the various shifts of art are naturally called forth? Great attention to decorum, which was carried to a degree of scrupulosity, and all that puerile bustle about trifles and consequential solemnity which Butler's caricature of a dissenter brings before the imagination, shaped their persons as well as their minds in the mould of prim littleness. I speak collectively, for I know how many ornaments to human nature have been enrolled among sectaries. Yet I assert that the same narrow prejudice for their sect which women have for their families prevailed in the dissenting part of the community, however worthy in other respects, and also that the same timid prudence or headstrong efforts often disgraced the exertions of both. Oppression thus formed many of the features of their character perfectly to coincide with that of the oppressed half of mankind. For is it not notorious that dissenters were, like women, fond of deliberating together and asking advice of each other, till by a complication of little contrivances some little end was brought about? A similar attention to preserve their reputation was conspicuous in the dissenting and female world, and was produced by a similar cause. Asserting the rights which women in common with men ought to contend for, I have not attempted to extenuate their faults, but to prove them to be the natural consequence of their education and station in society. If so, it is reasonable to suppose that they will change their character and correct their vices and follies when they are allowed to be free in a physical, moral, and civil sense. Let women share the rights, and she will emulate the virtues of man. For she must grow more perfect when emancipated, or justify the authority that chains such a weak being to her duty. If the latter, it will be expedient to open a fresh trade with Russia for whips, a present which a father should always make to his son-in-law on his wedding day, that a husband may keep his whole family in order by the same means, and without any violation of justice reign, wielding this sceptre, sole master of his house, because he is the only being in it who has reason, the divine, indefeasible earthly sovereignty breathed into man by the master of the universe. Allowing this position, women have not any inherent rights to claim, and by the same rule their duties vanish, for rights and duties are inseparable. Be just then, O ye men of understanding, and mark not more severely what women do amiss than the vicious tricks of the horse or the ass for whom ye provide provender, and allow her the privileges of ignorance, to whom ye deny the rights of reason, or ye will be worse than Egyptian taskmasters, expecting virtue where nature has not given understanding.
Chapter 5. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me, that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 in the morning. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe? Or how delineate the wretch whom with such infinite pains and care I had endeavored to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set. His shriveled complexion and straight black lips. The different accidents of life are not so changeable as the feelings of human nature. I had worked hard for nearly 2 years for the sole purpose of infusing life into an inanimate body. For this I had deprived myself of rest and health. I had desired it with an ardor that far exceeded moderation, but now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created, I rushed out of the room and continued a long time traversing my bedchamber, unable to compose my mind to sleep. At length, lassitude succeeded to the tumult I had before endured, and I threw myself on the bed in my clothes, endeavoring to seek a few moments of forgetfulness, but it was in vain. I slept, indeed, but I was disturbed by the wildest dreams. I thought I saw Elizabeth in the bloom of health, walking in the streets of Ingolstadt. Delighted and surprised, I embraced her, but as I imprinted the first kiss on her lips, they became livid with the hue of death. Her features appeared to change, and I thought that I held the corpse of my dead mother in my arms. A shroud enveloped her form, and I saw the grave worms crawling in the folds of flannel. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead, my teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed. When, by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtain of the bed, and his eyes, if eyes they may be called, were fixed on me. His jaws opened, and he muttered some inarticulate sounds while a grin wrinkled his cheeks. He might have spoken, but I did not hear. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed downstairs. I took refuge in the courtyard belonging to the house which I inhabited, where I remained during the rest of the night, walking up and down in the greatest agitation, listening attentively, catching and fearing each sound, as if it were to announce the approach of the demoniacal corpse to which I had so miserably given life. Oh, no mortal could support the horror of that countenance. A mummy, again endued with animation, could not be so hideous as that wretch. I had gazed on him while unfinished. He was ugly then, but when those muscles and joints were rendered capable of motion, it became a thing such as even Dante could not have conceived. I passed the night wretchedly. Sometimes my pulse beat so quickly and hardly that I felt the palpitation of every artery. At others I nearly sank to the ground through languor and extreme weakness. Mingled with this horror, I felt the bitterness of disappointment. Dreams that had been my food and pleasant rest for so long a space were now become a hell to me, and the change was so rapid, the overthrow so complete. Morning, dismal and wet, at length dawned, and discovered to my sleepless and aching eyes the church of Ingolstadt, its white steeple and clock, which indicated the sixth hour.
Okay, well, do you want to run us through what
after Mary Wollstonecraft, the reading of A Vindication of the Rights of Women, we had Mary Wollstonecraft's daughter's virtuosic piece of writing, mm-hmm. Frankenstein, written by Mary Shelley and read by Dan Stevens.
Who was reading the first bit? Do you know?
I don't really know. It was something from an Oxford University reading.
Right. There was a bit of a strange squeak in the background. I don't know what that was. Kind of recording glitch, I think.
Right. But we got the message nevertheless, didn't we?
Yes.
I mean, it was a great piece of...
Well, it led quite nicely into Frankenstein, mechanical...
But it also indicated just what seriously fabulous writers each person was.
Yeah.
And then we then played P.J. Harvey and John Parrish with Black Hearted Love, which I thought was, has shades of the Frankenstein thing about it, I think. The darkness and the black-heartedness.
It's all quite dark so far.
Yes.
Quite gothic in feeling, the mood so far, anyway.
Yes, right. So now we're going into something completely different, which is Virginia Woolf on the art of writing, Virginia Woolf being one of the great modernist writers. From a BBC radio recording reading in 1937. The surprise here for me is I've never heard Virginia Woolf's voice, and it is quite surprising. I don't know why.
Okay, so is this her? She is speaking herself.
She's
in 1937.
Yeah.
Yeah, from craftsmanship.
Putting my hands before my eyes, for I thought I saw the dreaded spectre glide.
That sounds like Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Well. Now, why has that happened? Not sure.
Should be number four down.
Yeah. Okay, we'll try again. Nope. We're having an issue with that. Okay, well...
We could play the Angela Davis whilst we sort that out.
Oh, yes. Okay, let's play Angela Davis, because that was the plan to do that before, anyway, to do it afterwards.
People have often asked me over the years, how did you become an activist? Now, what made you decide to become an activist? What was that pivotal event in your life? And for years and years, I thought about it. I tried to... Now, when did I really become an activist? You know, what happened that made me commit my life to doing this work? And I came up with some ideas. You know, at one point I said, well, it must have been when 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama was bombed. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, and knew Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and the two other girls who were killed during that church. As a matter of fact, my mother took the mother of Carol to the church to pick her up after they discovered that the church had been bombed. And that did have a profound effect on me. These were, girls in my neighborhood, friends of my sister's, girls my mother had taught in school that I knew. So for a while I decided that, that was what had set me on that path. But then I thought, actually I was active before 1963. So, it couldn't have been then. So I came up with various explanations, events, pivotal events in my life. And finally, after struggling with this for years, I decided that there really was no particular moment when I decided to become an activist. As a matter of fact, I grew up with the idea that in order to live in segregated circumstances, Birmingham was the most segregated city in the South when I grew up there, that my parents basically taught us that we had to be critical of the way things were. Otherwise, we could not affirm our own humanity. And that we had to dedicate our lives to the kind of transformation that would make this a better world to live in, you know, for all of us. And so I guess I've learned that wherever I am, whatever I happen to be doing at the moment, I have to fulfill that commitment that has informed my life. So I want to begin by suggesting that whoever you are, you know, wherever you are, you know, whether you are a student, an academic, whether you are a worker, whether you are a person involved in your church, whether you are an artist, there are always ways to gear your work towards progressive, radical transformation. And I'm going to try to argue for the need to bring about some radical structural changes in this society.
Okay, so that was Angela Davis. The tracks are slightly out of order, and that was from the Prison Industrial Complex, a lecture in 1997 on becoming an activist. Okay, we can return now to Virginia Woolf. The issue was that Frankenstein was still going on in the background since it's a reading of the whole book, and I hadn't actually ceased Frankenstein. So just tell us again what this Virginia Woolf piece is.
This is Virginia Woolf talking about the idea of craftsmanship,
right,
as to be employed in writing,
yeah,
in 1937.
Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations. They've been out and about on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing in today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past. The splendid word incarnadine, for example, who can use that without remembering multitudinous seas? In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word in an old language because of the very obvious, yet always mysterious fact that a word is not a single and separate entity. It is part of other words. Indeed, it is not a word until it is part of a sentence. Words belong to each other. Although, of course, only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas. To combine new words with old words is fatal to the constitution of the sentence. In order to use new words properly, you would have to invent a whole new language, and that, though no doubt we shall come to it, is not at the moment our business. Our business is to see what we can do with the old English language as it is. How can we combine the old words in new orders?
Well, it's quite an interesting sort of modernist rendition of craftsmanship. There seems to have got into some sort of loop there.
Yes, which is, but it did return to its proper place. But
indeed, we
sort of the good thing there was just to be able to hear Virginia Woolf's voice, I think.
Absolutely.
Talking about in a way that probably people aren't familiar because people are just used to reading the books. Hopefully, they're used to reading the books anyway.
Right.
So now we're going into even blacker territory with Anne Sexton. I hadn't really realised that my taste was quite so. Anyway, Anne Sexton was an American poet who won the Pulitzer Prize for her great poems. What I like about them is the realism, the stark, straight to the reader.
Yeah. And we've got two pieces by Anne Sexton coming up.
Yeah.
Intercut with a piece by Jean Rhys called On Happiness. Not sure when recorded, but she died in 1979. And Sexton, this piece is called Wanting to Die. She died in 1974. But then we feel we sort of end on a high note with Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, because that follows on directly from the Anne Sexton second poem, which is called For My Lover, which is a much lighter piece.
Okay. All right. I'll trust you on this.
But you said the world's going to die. You know, the world, the earth, it's going to be over. I said, well, I never lied to you. You see, I can explain sex in a minute, but death, I can't explain.
Wanting to die. Since you ask, most days I cannot remember. I walk in my clothing, unmarked by that voyage. Then the almost unnameable lust returns. Even then, I have nothing against life. I know well the grass blades you mention, the furniture you have placed under the sun. But suicides have a special language. Like carpenters, they want to know which tools. They never ask why build. Twice I have so simply declared myself, have possessed the enemy, eaten the enemy, have taken on his craft, his magic. In this way, heavy and thoughtful, warmer than oil or water, I have rested, drooling at the mouth hole. I did not think of my body at needlepoint. Even the cornea and the leftover urine were gone. Suicides have already betrayed the body. Stillborn, they don't always die. But dazzled, they can't forget a drug so sweet that even children would look on and smile. To thrust all that life under your tongue, that all by itself becomes a passion. Death's a sad bone. Bruised, you'd say. And yet she waits for me, year after year, to so delicately undo an old wound, to empty my breath from its bad prison. Balance there, suicides sometimes meet, raging at the fruit, a pumped-up moon, leaving the bread they mistook for a kiss, leaving the page of the book carelessly open, something unsaid, the phone off the hook, and the love, whatever it was, an infection.
When I was excited about life, I didn't want to write at all. I've never written about being happy, never. I didn't want to. Besides, I don't think you can describe being happy. I've never had a long period of being happy. Do you think anybody has? I think you can be peaceful for quite a long time. But to be happy is different, isn't it? And that's a bit rare, I can't help feeling. But then altogether, I think if I had to choose, I'd rather be happy than right. If I had my life all over again and could choose.
For my lover returning to his wife. She is all there. She was carefully melted down for you and cast up from your childhood, cast up from your 100 favorite Aggies. She has always been there, my darling. She is, in fact, exquisite. Fireworks in the dull middle of February and as real as a cast-iron pot. Let's face it, I have been momentary, a luxury. A bright red sloop in the harbor, my hair rising like smoke from the car window. Little neck clams out of season. She is more than that. She is your have-to-have. Has grown you your practical, your tropical growth. This is not an experiment. She is all harmony. She sees to the oars and oarlocks for the dinghy. Has placed wildflowers at the window at breakfast.
sat by the potter's wheel at midday, set forth three children under the moon, three cherubs drawn by Michelangelo, done this with her legs spread out in the terrible months in the chapel. If you glance up, the children are there, like delicate balloons rising on the ceiling. She has also carried each one down the hall after supper, their heads privately bent, two legs protesting, person to person, her face flushed with a song in their little sleep. I give you back your heart. I give you permission. For the fuse inside her throbbing angrily in the dirt. For the bitch in her and the burying of her wound. For the burying of her small red wound alive. For the pale flickering flare under her ribs. For the drunken sailor who waits in her left pulse. For the mother's knee. For the stockings. For the garter belt. For the call. The curious call. When you will burrow in arms and breasts and tug at the orange ribbon in her hair and answer the call, the curious call. She is so naked and singular. She is the sum of yourself and your dream. Climb her like a monument, step after step. She is solid. As for me, I am a watercolor. I wash off.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. Another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, and you're the key to my peace of mind. 'Cause you make me feel, you make me feel, you make me feel like a natural woman.
Woman.
When my soul was in the lost and found, you came along to claim it. I didn't know just what was wrong with me till your kiss helped me name it. Now I'm no longer doubtful of what I'm living for, and if I make you happy, I don't need to do more. 'Cause you make me feel, you make me feel, you make me feel like a natural woman.
Woman.
Oh, baby, what you've done to me.
What you've done to me.
You make me feel so good inside.
Good inside.
And I just want.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with today's guest, DJ Hybridist, sharing her selection of The Strength of the Female Voice with you, the Wavelength listeners.
Yes, so that was obviously Aretha Franklin singing a song that was written for her by Carole King and Jerry Goffin. And the song that apparently she sang to President Obama, and he was just openly weeping,
right.
as you do when you hear that song.
I do. It is a fantastic line about the
you were in Lost and Found.
The heart claiming.
You came along to claim it. Yes, like you were lost property.
When my heart was in the Lost and Found, you came along to claim it.
It is
a brilliant.
And I'm sure that must be Carole King's piece of writing in that song.
Right.
But that's a perfect amalgamation of two people, Carole King and Jerry Goffin, who wrote some of the most.
Yeah.
The greatest songs.
Yeah.
So we're just going...
And we certainly needed uplifting after the previous ones.
Yes. Well, this is the struggle, isn't it? You know, it is... it's tough out there.
Yes. But is this particularly a women's story? A woman's story? Anne Sexton... Jean Rhys didn't end well, did she, either?
No.
wondered if you wanted to expand on that at all.
Well, neither did Virginia Woolf, unfortunately.
Exactly, that's right.
Yes.
I mean, there's quite a dark stories here.
There
I don't
are
know
some
what
dark
happened
stories.
To Angela Davis. Do we know?
She's still around.
She's still around. Yeah. Oh, good. Thank God for that. Okay.
Well, it may be what you're hinting at is the internal nature of writing, as opposed to the idea of being an activist, which is a very proactive thing to do. You're actually, you know, helping other people in a very obvious way.
All right.
So now we're going to hear Dorothy Parker, who wrote her biography called You Might As Well Live.
okay.
This is a piece called The Telephone Call, which is another piece of desperate longing on the part of a woman, read by the actress Tallulah Bankhead in the 1930s.
Yeah. Dorothy Parker, can you remind me?
She was unusual in that she, at the time, in the 1930s, she was really smart, really wisecracking, sassy kind of woman. I'm digressing now.
Write about Hollywood, or was she sort of
no,
columnist?
She was part of the Algonquin Round Table, which was an entirely male coterie, and she could drink with the best of them, and write just as well.
Okay, so this is her. This is what's this called?
It's called Telephone Call, and it's read by Tallulah Bankhead.
Okay.
Waiting for a phone call that never comes can be so utterly... Well, you just sit there wondering and talking to yourself. Dorothy Parker captured the feeling in that wonderful vignette titled A Telephone Call. Please, God... Let him telephone me now. Dear God, let him call me now. I won't ask anything else of you, truly, I won't. It isn't very much to ask. It would be so little to you, God, such a little thing. Only let him telephone now. Please, God. Please, please. If I didn't think about it, maybe the telephone might ring. Oh, I could think of something else. Maybe if I count it 500 by 5, it might ring by that time. I'll count slowly. I won't cheat. I won't cheat. And if it rings when I get to 300, I won't stop. I won't answer until it gets to 500. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35. Oh, please ring, please. This is the last time I look at that clock. I will not look at it again. 7:10. He said he would telephone at 5:00. I'll call you at 5, darling. I think that's what he said. That's where he said, darling. I'm almost sure he said it there. I know he called me darling twice. And the other time when he said, oh, shut up, darling. He was busy and he can't say much in the office, but he called me darling twice. He couldn't have minded my calling him up. I know I shouldn't keep bothering them. I know they don't like that. But I hadn't talked to them in 3 days. Not in 3 days. And well, I was asking how it was. It was just the way anybody might call him up. He couldn't have thought I was bothering him. No, of course you're not, he said. And he said he'd telephone me. But he didn't have to say that. I didn't ask him to. Truly, I didn't. I'm sure I didn't. I don't think he would say he'd telephone me and then... Let's never do it.
Well, it's an intriguing piece.
Very much a period piece, very much of the 30s, isn't it?
Yeah. But if we're going to get through any more of these tracks,
so
we
let's
have
just
to press
hear
on.
A little flavour of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who many people consider to be one of the main players in rock and roll. She played the Gibson guitar and she sang also. This is just a series of her guitar riffs all strung together, so we could just hear a few of them.
Right. So this is Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yes.
And what were you saying about her being the...
Well, a lot of people, musicians, regard... she's very highly regarded in certain quarters, and some say that she was one of the originators of rock and roll, although I suppose there are many people who make that claim.
Yeah.
But she played the Gibson guitar, as you can hear, and also sang, and so it's a combination of spirituals and...
Indeed, and she's in front of a huge gospel choir with one of these tracks.
Right, so it's quite an eclectic mix.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, and your next track is something by Little Axe.
Yes, this is a slight cheat in a sense, because I wanted to reference a woman called Sylvia Robinson, who started the Sugar Hill record label, and these were with her husband, but she was a main player, and it was the first hip-hop label. And Little Axe, whose real name is Skip McDonald, was actually in the house band at Sugar Hill, and he also played with Grandmaster Flash.
Right. Hence the Sugar Hill Gang, I suppose.
Yeah,
is
the
that
Sugar
right?
Hill Gang was was the first. I can't remember what their track was called.
All
anyway,
right.
So this is Little Axe from the album The Wolf That House Built.
Okay. When does this date from?
1994, and it's called Ride On.
Okay. I'm going to get rid of Sister Rosetta Tharpe in case that's running on in the background again, like Frankenstein was. But
Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and
I don't ride on. I don't
gathered right on.
And Damascus. The masses are in Damascus. The masses have their faces in their races to save their races. Tell your bases not to traces. These seeds are about to embrace us. On the land we get the tasers, and these waves might capsize us. And who the fuck is ISIS? Send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus. Dropping buns in Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus. Dropping buns in Damascus. Get the scissors, get the scissors. Cut the rope on the bridges. To find a better way to reach brand new edges. Get the scissors, get the scissors. Cut the rope on the bridges. Have to find a better way to reach brand new edges. Send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus, send Damascus.
Yes, apologies for the expletive there. Which
yeah,
sprung
sorry about
in
that. This was this is by Mia, who is a so the other one, the Sugar Hill reference, provided a good segue for Mia, who's an activist, a British rapper and singer and songwriter, who is has Sri Lankan origins. And this was released on Twitter, actually.
Oh, really?
Anyway,
okay.
I mean, she's successful generally, but anyway, so that's kind of it. And if we just...
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you very much to DJ Hybridis for for your selection for One Day After International Women's Day.
Yeah.
And 90 years after all women over the age of 21 were allowed to vote. And DJ Hybridis shared her selection of The Strength of the Female Voice. This week, and we're going to end with
Nina Simone.
Nina Simone. And where does this hark from?
Because there's a apparently, bit of history about it's an amalgamation of two songs that were used in the musical Hair.
Uh-huh.
I'd always assumed it was written by her, but unfortunately, it isn't. But she sings it.
Okay,
and fantastically, this, passionately.
So it ends on a life affirming note.
And a life affirming, well, yeah, some.
Ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweaters, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no love, ain't got no faith. I ain't got no culture, ain't got no mother, ain't got no father, ain't got no brother, ain't got no children, ain't got no aunts, ain't got no uncles, ain't got no love, ain't got no mind. I ain't got no country, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no
my hair, cut my hair, cut my brains, cut my ears, cut my eyes, cut my nose, cut my mouth.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.